Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Xbox Expansion Pass. I am your host, Luke Lore, the Insipid Ghost, and today I am joined by the author of three different books on the gaming industry, as well as the games journalist for Bloomberg News, Jason Schreier. Jason, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Luke. Thanks for having me on.
I am grateful for your time. As I was saying, I am grateful to pick your brain today. I think you've certainly had a week. You have certainly had a week.
Yeah, it's been eventful. That's for sure. Very tragic for a lot of people, but eventful.
You and that is one of the things I really do want to jump in on. I will start by saying you are one of the most successful, prolific journalists in the gaming industry. And I think people look to you to be a voice in the gaming industry. And you have the unique responsibility with that voice to be speaking to the ill-informed, to be speaking to industry professionals, to publishers who adhere to your words and spotlighting things. And I feel like navigating that, whether you're talking to the ill-informed, the enthusiast press, the publishers, the developers, that has to be difficult. No?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see my job that way. I see my job as someone who is out here to inform people and hopefully entertain people too, but mostly to inform people by telling stories and relaying information and kind of sharing what I hear and speaking truth to power and all of that good stuff. So I don't really see it as like, I don't know. I mean, I guess educating people about how the video game industry works is a part of that, but I don't really see it as kind of like this, like I'm on some cloud in a council of elders who has to come on down and kind of lecture people about what's what. That's less my job so much as kind of telling stories that that other people can't or other people can't get access to.
You've certainly done that across any number of outlets, most recently since 2020 with Bloomberg and across your three different books. One of the things I find interesting is that gaming is meant to be this very fun, recreational event. And yet I feel like it's very, very much become tribal, to include a far more immature version of myself participating in that. And, you know, I don't just mean Xbox versus PlayStation or Nintendo versus Sega. It really feels like gamer culture has its own vibe and feeling. And I feel like when you are sharing information, telling those stories, sometimes you're talking to gamers, sometimes you're talking to people outside of that tribal culture. Do you sense that when you are forming your theses, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The video game industry is really dense and opaque, and it's really hard to know what's going on unless you're like super immersed in gaming culture. So something I try pretty hard to do is write in a way that is accessible to everybody. My metric for my books is like, I want my mother to be able to read them, or like some friend. I want to be able to tell stories to a friend at a bar and for them to understand it, even if they aren't constantly playing every single new game and reading IGN every day and checking the forums. To your point about tribalism, it's interesting. I think that's kind of a separate issue than the kind of the gaming enthusiast gamer versus non-gamer divide, because I think that's a lot easier to bridge. Tribalism, on the other hand, that's become a more intractable problem. I think that the console war thing, that seems less relevant to me these days, in large part because the console war doesn't really exist anymore. Xbox has essentially become a multi-platform game publisher. And so this idea of like two companies that are competing over exclusives is not really relevant. But the tribalism that I've seen is more along the lines of people who people who are progressive minded versus people who don't believe that diversity and inclusion and equity has a place in games or the games industry. And that I've seen kind of intensify a lot more over the last decade or so as the console war has come in retreat. So that form of tribalism is definitely still there, but not as not quite the same as the kind of the gamer non-gamer divide, I would say, which is a much easier gap to bridge.
Mm-hmm. I think about a lot of that, and I look back at my consumer habits, the way I spoke about different things, and I often wonder, you know, is there a step that I should be taking to kind of bridge that gap even more so? And I find myself, you know, I almost enjoy a good Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo conversation versus what you're talking about, having to, you know, is there diversity and inclusion, progressivism, conservatism? I find the two conversations separate, but I feel they often blend when I don't ask them to.
You find that the console war conversation blends with the kind of
the spaces that those console wars will exist in tend to bring those conversations about.
Interesting.
Do you see something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not as kind of, I'm not as immersed in the forums these days. I never really found console wars all that interesting. I was always kind of the opinion that all big corporations are kind of the same and they're all to be kind of held accountable. And it doesn't really matter which gaming box is selling the most copies. In fact, I'm a big fan of the multi-platform approach because I feel like the less gatekeeping there is, the better it is for everybody. If people just have to buy one box to be able to play everything, that's just a win for everybody all around. The conversation over kind of woke and versus anti-woke, too, for lack of a better term, I think is a lot more insidious and poisonous and dangerous and has already caused quite a few problems. Largely because it's not really a debate over kind of degrees or a spectrum of progressiveness or politics in the industry. It's more of this kind of warfare where this group of very large YouTubers with very large audiences will find really individual people, sometimes weak people, people with no power whatsoever, and single them and target them and really make their lives miserable, make their internet Google search results miserable, just really destroy them in a lot of ways. And that is really dangerous and toxic. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what can you do about that. And that, I think, it takes the kind of the discourse, the gaming world's discourse, to an extreme that we hadn't seen ever in the console war days. Like, we're talking about a different world now. Never before, I mean, when Xbox and PlayStation fans were going at it, there wasn't really a world in which people were like identifying a mid-level marketing manager at Xbox and being like, this person is the devil, let's all send our millions of followers after them, in the way that that's happening now. And so very different degrees of kind of toxicity on the internet, I would say.
You have, I think, one of the unique opportunities that sheds light onto C-suite conversations, and your mention of like YouTubers and spotlighting kind of mid-level people. It makes me wonder how much those events that take place when they do, you know, spotlight people as woke or target them or have them, you know, their search histories be so negative. How does it impact C-suite level decisions? You know, we're seeing news of WB, which I know we'll get to, but they had a PR nightmare on their hands with Hogwarts Legacy in many ways. Are those related conversations?
So, well, that is a very different conversation, but I guess kind of related. I mean, I think that's still kind of unfolding. I think a lot of game companies are still trying to figure out at the very highest levels how they want to approach it. A, when one of their employees is attacked on the internet, what do they do? In some cases, it's nothing. In other cases, they might offer protection services or kind of like internet like services. Like, there's a service called Delete Me that kind of like deletes your address from the internet if it's online anywhere, that sort of thing, for security purposes. So there are a few options that some companies have, but really, I mean, I think a lot of people are just kind of trying to navigate this new world, especially with the US government cracking down on a lot of diversity initiatives and trying to make it illegal to talk about diversity. And so companies are just are still trying to navigate that. So I don't think there's an answer to that question just yet.
Do you see business decisions changing, you know, like as far as like marketing certain games or deciding what content goes into certain games?
Yes, I think so. I think it's still being decided. So like, there's nothing specific that I know about where like a company is like, you know, we're going to do this thing because we're afraid of this wokeism. I think it's a relatively recent phenomenon, and some of these decisions will still be made over the coming years. But I think so. I mean, the one thing that I think we still don't really know the answer to is whether these kind of campaigns, internet hatred campaigns, actually affect the sales of games, because we've seen the data. I've seen, at least, like, I have not seen any sort of correlation between a game's like level of diversity or wokeism and its sales, because we've seen games that have progressive themes flop, and we've seen games that have progressive themes sell tens of millions of copies. Hogwarts Legacy, I mean, for all of the flack around that game because of author J.K. Rowling's controversial opinions about transgender people, for all the flack we saw, this is also a game where like one of the first characters you meet is a transgender bartender. And so it's really hard to say. I don't really think there's much of a correlation. To me, it seems like, and all the data we've seen points to this, it seems like if a game is really good and it is enjoyable to play and feels like a polished, like satisfying experience, then it has a good chance of selling well, no matter what the politics involved are. So I don't think it's a factor. But again, we'll see. And some companies might believe it's a factor. Companies in general, not just in gaming, but all around U.S. Capitalism, companies tend to be conservative minded, and they want to mitigate risk as much as possible. And so if they see these kind of anti-woke YouTubers as a risk, then they might be trying to mitigate that and might be trying to stay out of that. We've already seen, as an example, Ubisoft come out and be like, no, none of our games are political. We're not trying to make any political statements, and offer those kind of like mealy mouth statements, which don't really say anything to anyone. But yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly something that I am keeping an eye on, and maybe there will be studies that kind of offer more definitive answers about like whether progressive themes have an impact on sales of games one way or another. But to date, we have not seen that, despite the kind of vibes based analysis that you might see on the internet where people are like, go woke, go broke. That's not something that has been shown with data.
I appreciate you commenting on that, because to me, from the outside looking in, I have the opportunity to, like, when I look at Blood, Sweat and Pixels all the way through Play Nice, it's consistent spotlighting and commentary on the game development culture, right? And I wonder how much on my side of the screen, be it as a consumer, gamer, enthusiast, press on some occasions, how much of that makes its way over. And, you know, companies that are trying to mitigate risks, logically, I wonder if that's the case, because we see so many shut down because they are not willing to take a risk in some cases. And I don't know if there is a correlation there.
It's interesting. I think it depends on what type of risks you're talking about, but it's kind of, it becomes this almost like Sisyphean cycle, where these companies are spending so much money on these games, and that those numbers just increase exponentially every single year or every few years. Just to give you a concrete example, Naughty Dog in 2009 released Uncharted 2, and that game cost $20 million. And then 11 years later released The Last of Us Part 2, and that game cost $220 million. So literal exponential growth here, right? In the budgets of these games. And as a result of these enormous budgets, these companies are like, man, we better like check every box. We better mitigate risk, because we need to make a lot of money. We need to make this game serve every single potential audience member so that it can reach as many people as possible. And then as a result, they get watered down. A game like, I don't know, Star Wars Outlaws comes to mind. I enjoyed a lot about that game, but that game felt like it had way too much in it. It was kind of a checklist of open world features. It was like, you need your shooting, you need your stealth, you need your crafting, you need your bike riding, you need your bounties and your quests. And it was really just a checklist of stuff that Ubisoft felt like it had to stuff in there, because that game's budget was so huge and it had to reach like 10 million people to be a success or whatever it was. And as a result of that, it was just kind of like a jack of all trades, but master of none. And so it was kind of a mid-level experience and didn't reach that many people. Whereas you look at a game like Baldur's Gate 3, which, by the way, first of all, the kind of a quintessential example of how being a woke game can still be like critical and commercial acclaim, sell bazillion copies. But also, Baldur's Gate 3 is a game that takes a lot of risks, despite its own kind of big budget. It was released in early access. That was one way. It's interesting. Early access, I think, is both a risk and an attempt to mitigate risk. Because it's risky to be like, we're going to release our game early and people can play an early version of it. But it's also mitigating risk because they're bringing in revenue for years before it's released. So that's kind of an interesting case study. But still, that's a game that takes a lot of risks. I mean, it's turn-based combat. It's got a lot of choices, a lot of content that players will never see on their first playthrough, or if they only play it once, they will just never see it. It's got really esoteric D&D style rules. It's just a very risky game. And that game, of course, did phenomenally well. It sold a bazillion copies and was Game of the Year in 2023, in part because it took those risks and was willing to just say, hey, we're going to appeal to a very specific type of player and hopefully enough people will give it a shot. And they did. So, I think that, like, by mitigating risks, your cost and I can understand the kind of instinct to mitigate risk, because when you're spending more and more on these games, you feel like you have to just make it broadly appealing, but you're kind of increasing the risk by trying to mitigate the risk because you're making your game so watered down that it's not actually going to appeal to all that many people.
It's funny. None of this was what I had planned to talk about, but I find it so fascinating because we've mentioned The Last of Us. We've mentioned Hogwarts. We mentioned Baldur's Gate, all of which had LGBTQ plus representation throughout there. And yet the bar of quality was so high, it didn't seem to stagger sales or interest or anything. The conversation wasn't about those things.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about those YouTubers and that kind of sector of the internet, it's interesting because I think I think there might be a conversation to be had about representation and when it feels kind of clunky and when it feels ham-handed or it feels like it's trying to lecture the player. And maybe Dragon Age Veilguard is a good example of like when to can you have that conversation about that? But the problem is that a lot of these YouTubers and a lot of these forums and kind of communities just are so toxic and so anti-representation that that's not the conversation they're trying to have. The conversation they're trying to have is they do not want representation in their games, which to me, and I think to most kind of normal-minded people, that is stupid. Like, what kind of world would we want to live in where, like, every single game is just about the same kind of archetype of person? That is extremely boring to think about. And I'll give you a good example of that, which is the recently announced Naughty Dog game, Intergalactic: The Heretic Prophet, which was announced in December at the Game Awards with like this 4.5 minute trailer that really, I mean, just showed the tone of the game, but it was mostly CG, like it was, or mostly like rendered rather than gameplay. It wasn't something that gave you much information about the game. But that became a lightning rod for some of these YouTubers because it stars a black woman with a shaved head. Literally, that is the only reason. And so I think the mask has kind of come off a lot of these people. It used to be kind of the anti-woke brigade used to talk about these things under the guise of like, well, I'm okay with diversity. I just don't want lecturing. I just don't want politics in my face in these games. And when those same people are going after this game because it stars a black woman with a shaved head, that's kind of like, all right, mask is off. Like, you just don't want non-white people in your game. You just don't want someone who looks different or like off-putting to you in your game. And that is where like you have to really draw a line and be like, no, like this is bullshit. Like, I'm just not even going to pay attention because your opinion is worthless if that is your argument.
Agreed. And as a enthusiast pressed Z-list influencer, but a blonde hair, blue eyed white man. I'm conscious of those things. And so I appreciate the insight on that one.
I want to make this point. I just want to reiterate on this one point, which is that, like,
sure,
I think that really poisons the water of what you can discuss and the kind of having more educated, insightful, nuanced conversations about this sort of thing. Because if you want to talk about how, like, hey, I don't mind having a transgender character in this game, but this conversation felt really kind of poorly implemented to me. It felt like an after-school special. It didn't feel interesting to me, and here is why. You can't even have that conversation because of what these YouTubers and, like, these anti-SJW whatever these communities have done to, like, the internet discourse. And that is a real shame, because I feel like we deserve better, more insightful, more critical, more nuanced, more interesting conversations about representation in video games and, like, when that is done well, when it is not done well. I think there are a lot of examples of that, and I think that people of some of those kind of like minorities or those groups that are have been kind of oppressed in various ways, like, even those people want to have more nuanced, complicated conversations. But, like, the water has been totally poisoned by these just, like, outraged merchants.
Yep. No, I fully agree, because there are nuanced conversations that I'm privileged to have in, like, our Discord and such about characters and writing in Dragon Age. Subtle character writing that occurs in Avowed, one of my very, I very much enjoy it. Subtle, quiet, you have to look to find it.
Yeah,
it is so totally good. Is. I truly love it.
Man, the writing in that game is so subtle. And that game also has become, like, a target of the anti-woke brigade. I don't even know why. There's nothing in it that is, like radically progressive. It's just, it's an Obsidian game. It's a lot of choice and consequence and nuance. And, man, that game is fantastic. It's one of my favorites of the year so far, if not my favorite from the year so far.
It made my day when I saw on your timeline how much you were enjoying it. And it again, enthusiast pressed, right? That's the best. I think the most polite and generous description I get to describe XCP as. I got to talk to Carrie Patel. I saw you could talk to Carrie Patel. Just a lovely human being, individual, talented, and brought her game to gamers. And I really appreciate her work. I'm going to bring us back, if you don't mind, because we had such a great conversation. So I want to loop back a bit, because this week you broke some pretty big news as far as the WB Games just having a slew of closings. Monolith, Player First, Warner Brothers Games of San Diego. Some great reporting on that. And I'll point people also to Kinda Funny's interview with you yesterday. You shed some wonderful light there as well. Goodness gracious. I was asking you earlier about C-suites and some of the possible disconnect between gamers and whatnot, but it feels like this is just a mess.
Yeah, man. I mean, so I wrote a story a couple of weeks ago, actually, in early February, about WB Games and the kind of the struggles they've been having over the last few years under their president, David Haddad, which led to David Haddad getting ousted earlier this year. So he's out of there. And JB Perrette, who was Haddad's boss and was the head of games and streaming at WB, he's now going to take over, and he wants to return to profitability this year. And one of his first moves as kind of part of that strategy of returning to profitability and doubling down on their big franchises, one of his first moves was to close three studios, including the venerable Monolith Productions, which was making Wonder Woman, and he also canceled Wonder Woman. So very big deal. A lot of people losing their jobs as a result of this. But it's just very tragic, and it's the result of mismanagement over the last 10 years or so. And I can give the short version of the Monolith story, but yeah, people can check out my story on Bloomberg and also my interview with Kinda Funny for, like, a bigger picture. I don't want to just rehash everything I said there, but short version is, after Shadow of War, which was their second Lord of the Rings Middle-earth game in 2017, after that, the team at Monolith started working on a new IP for a few years. There was kind of like a will they, won't they back and forth with WB and the executives there. And it was almost like a standoff, but, like, it was all very confusing. Eventually it was canceled. The entire leadership group at Monolith then left. Most of them went to form a new studio with EA called Cliffhanger, where they're working on a Black Panther game. And Monolith was then given Wonder Woman, and they were put in the impossible situation of having to rebuild their studio and their entire leadership team while making this brand new game. And things didn't work out, and that led us to where we are today, unfortunately.
It seems to me like the lack of concise vision, and you talked about this in your article, you talked about, and you got quotes from JB Perrette about how this may not be a reflection on the teams and talent, but they are trying to get into a fewer but bigger franchise strategy. And they're going to focus on Harry Potter, Mortal Kombat, Game of Thrones, and they said DC, but your articulation was they meant Batman. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. And so there are two kind of statements that have been floating around. One is a statement from a Warner Brothers spokesperson that that they sent around to press. Mm-hmm. The other was an email that JB Perrette sent to his staff. Mm-hmm. And in the spokesperson statement, it says DC, just says DC. But in the, I'm going to pull this up on my phone. In the JB Perrette email, it says, here, I'm going to quote this for you. It says DC, and I'll quote, I'm reading from his email. Actually, let me read the entire sentence for context. Okay. We need to move faster to double down on our resources and investment in our most successful games IP with our biggest fan bases, which are the four $1 billion franchises we have discussed in the past. Harry Potter / Hogwarts Legacy, Mortal Kombat, DC, parentheses, primarily Batman when it comes to single character-led games, but may include select other opportunities as the new DCU gets built. End of parentheses. And Game of Thrones. So there's some context on like the DC versus Batman stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that's an exclusive for you. I haven't seen that quoted anywhere else.
Thank you, Jason Trier.
Gotcha.
There you go, my friend. It is, I will say, as a DC fan, it's been a rough few years. It's been difficult. I'm sitting in a Batman chair. I've got the Gotham Knights bit there because I really do enjoy a lot of DC properties, but it feels like there has been a lack of concise direction because WB Montreal was working on a Batman game, but not a Batman game because they didn't want him there. They didn't. And then you have Suicide Squad, which came out, and it just feels like they do not know what they want to do as far as the game they want to make. They know the franchises, but not the game they want to make. And that has to put the developers that you speak with in difficult positions.
Yeah, I think that the WB Montreal, I mean, that's a whole another saga where they like really struggled to kind of get straight answers out of Burbank about whether they could pursue a new thing or whether they were going to become a support studio, especially in recent years. So that's a whole nother thing. I think with Batman, yeah, I mean, if you look back at the history, right? So Batman obviously had a bazillion games, but let's cut to 2008 when Rocksteady released Arkham Asylum, 2006. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly somewhere the year, but around there, Arkham Asylum revolutionizes superhero games, makes mm-hmm. it like clear to everybody that games don't have to be on this like movie tie-in kind of license crap schedule. And Rocksteady goes on to release two more. WB Montreal releases its own. And after all that, I think there is kind of a vibe at both Rocksteady and WB Montreal that they were kind of done with making Batman games. They felt like after Arkham Knight, which came out in 2015, it was kind of like, I feel we've milked Batman for all it was worth. I don't know if we want to keep doing this. And so they both went in different directions and wanted to pursue just kind of other superheroes. This was also the point where like WB for some reason thought that Suicide Squad was like the best franchise on the planet and that they should double down on Suicide Squad, which seems a little nuts to me because it feels like there are some other worthy WB characters who or DC characters who could be explored, but that was the route that Rocksteady took. And then yeah, WB Montreal, their path was like, we want to make a Batman game without Batman. So the idea was you would play as his disciples, which actually seems to me like a pretty cool premise. And Gotham Knights, I mean, that game had some flaws, but it also felt, at least to me personally speaking, just kind of my own opinion, it felt like there was a good foundation there that maybe they could have built on in interesting ways. And that was a game that I think just suffered most because it didn't have combat as good as the Arkham games, which would have been impossible with a multiplayer game, because so much of like Arkham combat is based around time dilation and you just kind of punching baddies while slowing time down and getting that kind of like being surrounded, taking everybody out, that kind of Bruce Lee feel. And that's impossible with multiplayer because like it would look super weird if you're standing over there and your buddy is like slowing down enemies, like it just wouldn't work. So I think that was a flaw, but it could have been cool. I don't know. Again, this is me just speaking as a player. But yeah, from a biz perspective, the kind of the inside track on that is that after releasing that game, WB Montreal really had a hard time getting another project approved by Warner Brothers and getting a straight answer out of them.
You mentioned, again, I'll point people to the Kinda Funny interview and to your reporting, but you mentioned that with the Wonder Woman game that has since been canceled, they were toying with and trying to experiment with the Nemesis system. And that system deservedly gets a lot of credit for being a wonderful like system and idea through the Shadow of War and Shadow of Mordor games. Do you know if like Rocksteady explored possibilities of using this in a Batman franchise, or it was tinkered with to be in a future DC project prior to the Wonder Woman game that was canceled?
I don't know. I think WB Montreal maybe at some point was like, hey, we should play around with the Nemesis system. I think a lot of people have like thought about it, but I think it's easier said than done because so much of your game really has to be built around it. Like if you think about the way it works in the Mordor games, I assume you played those Mordor and yes. Shadow Mordor and Shadow of War. It's a lot of it. I haven't played those in a long time, but from my memory, a lot of the gameplay itself involves like interrogating the orcs and figuring out who has what weaknesses and where they are and just kind of like trying to track them down. And then you get killed by them and then come back to life. And a lot of the game, the core gameplay is based around that. And so if you're like trying to find other kind of like gameplay evolutions, it's hard to also have that. So I don't know. I don't know like what would be practical, and also technologically, it's a little bit easier said than done to just be like, we're going to take the Nemesis system and use it for something else. So I don't know. I don't know how practical that is.
I guess I asked because the Nemesis system gets so much discussion or so much spotlight, and we've only seen it, to my knowledge, in two games. And to me, somehow that feels light.
Yeah. It's two games by the same studio and by like a lot of people who went on to do something else. We'll see what happens with their Black Panther game, right? Because those are a lot of the kind of core people who worked on those games. We'll see if they then go on to like you do something equivalent in their next game. Because yeah, I mean, yes, it's a system that seems really cool from the outside, but like if you're a game developer, it's not like you can just graft that on to some other idea and make it work seamlessly. But yeah, it's cool. But again, it just like only works for a very specific type of game. And there's been obviously a lot made out of the patent stuff, which I think is a little bit overblown too. This idea that like Warner Brothers is patenting this mechanic, I think is a little bit overblown.
I guess now the question becomes, what are they going to do next? What's the internal feel? One of the things you reported on was how Monolith's leadership left, right? Like, they were essentially like exiting because the game that they were making, Warner didn't want to make it. And so they left.
Yeah, that was in 2021, to be clear. Not super recently, but yeah.
Correct. Yeah, yes, not recently. But that C-suite level executive leadership seems to impact those teams greatly. Well, now we have another turnover, another change this past January with Haddad leaving. The current employees that are still employed, I have to wonder, like, how close is a game for them? You know, like, what's that reportedly the next Batman game is on the drawing board?
Yeah, so the crux of the piece that I ran on Bloomberg a couple weeks ago before all this happened was that the next 2 years look pretty dire for Warner Brothers. There, as a result of a lot of the decisions Haddad made, there isn't a lot on the slate for the next couple of years. There's, like, a refresh of Hogwarts, definitive edition or whatever they call it with like some DLC stuff. There's a new Lego game coming, but there's not a lot. Some mobile games. And then after that, yeah, we're going to see them double down on the stuff. Like I just, like the email I just read, they're going to be doubling down on those big franchises and we'll see how long it actually takes them to release anything of them. But there'll be a new Hogwarts. There'll be that new Batman. There'll be, I'm sure, Game of Thrones games in some capacity. WB Montreal was pitching one last I heard. But yeah, a lot of this stuff is still years away. And so Warner Brothers has to have the patience to just kind of stick with it, which I guess we'll see if they do. The industry, a lot can change in the video game industry in just a couple of years. So we'll see what happens. But certainly, like if you're working on one of those games that JB Perrette mentioned, that's a lot more secure than like if you were working on Wonder Woman, which I think a lot of people at Monolith were caught off guard. Like nobody knew, had any idea that this studio closure was coming. But I do think there was a sense, at least in at some levels at Warner Brothers, there was a sense that Wonder Woman was kind of doomed and that it was probably not going to happen.
The I suppose the last kind of question-ish on this topic is, do you think the Monolith employees that were caught off guard were caught off guard because it's Monolith and they have such a storied track record?
Yeah, I mean, nobody thinks their studio is going to shut down. Like, it's it's always kind of shocking news. And yeah, like they've been around since 1994, I believe it is. So yeah, just shocking in a lot of ways. And I think that yeah, I mean, the last time their project was canceled, they got an opportunity to do something else. I don't know. It's shocking. It's always shocking when like your studio gets shut down, you find out that all this work you put into this project potentially for years and years and years will just never see the light of the day. It's just really tragic.
The gaps in those resumes have to be longer and longer in many cases. And if anybody has not read Play Nice and a few others, like there, you talk about this at various points.
Yeah, it's really sad. It's like, if you're an artist, if you're a concept artist or something, maybe you can show some of your art on a portfolio to people. But like, if you're a systems designer or something like that, it's not like you can have like potential employers like play the great systems that you were working on for the last 4 years. It's really just kind of gone into the ether. It's really tragic.
Super Chat says it give from the Trophy Room, a PlayStation podcast, says it gives LucasArts vibes with a revolving door. Does that ping on your radar in any way?
The revolving door? I'm not sure what they mean by that exactly.
I think he means that people are starting projects, not getting it seen. People are exiting out. We're seeing studios shut down.
Sure. I mean, Lucas definitely had some of its own kind of issues during its final years in existence. A lot of just kind of upheaval and presidents kind of shifting in and out and cancel projects. Yeah, definitely.
I know that Joe, who is the person on that account, recently read one of your books and had a very he really enjoyed that particular part. And one of the
Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, the final chapter of Blood, Sweat, and Pixels is about Star Wars 1313, and yeah, it gets into some of those final years of LucasArts.
Yeah, definitely worth a read for anybody that hasn't. He also mentioned that's exactly what it was. I want to make sure I read his comment properly. If you don't mind, with your closing minutes and time here, one of the things that was interesting, or if I find interesting, is how much the gaming space has changed. And we talked earlier about how Xbox is kind of multi-platform. They are multi-platform now. Like, it's that part of their chapter seems to be closed as far as making exclusive content.
Yeah, I feel like it's safe to say everything they release from now on is going to be multi-platform. Like, I'd be shocked if anything wasn't at this point.
I think maybe it's more mature or more recent version of me, but I'm okay with that now. And I'm curious, as somebody who gets to bump elbows with higher ups and the developers and such, do you feel an industry shift in mindset for Xbox in general?
Well, for Xbox, yeah, absolutely. And I think that that has been happening for a little while now. I think there was kind of this turning point for Xbox's fate, which was really when the Activision Blizzard deal closed. And that was when also amidst kind of an industry shift and like a pivot towards AI for Microsoft. And that was when Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft, and his lieutenants kind of looked down at Xbox and were like, hey, you just spent $69 billion. You better wrangle those P&Ls. You better get your finances into shape. And that's when Xbox started laying people off and shut some studios down. And that's when they started kind of putting together a plan that would be essentially releasing games on multiple consoles, because Xbox Game Pass is not showing growth and the console business for them is tiny. They're obviously the Xbox Series consoles have not performed nearly as well as the PlayStation. And so the best way towards more profitability for them was to release on PlayStation and Switch too. And to be fair, I mean, Phil Spencer has always been saying, he's been saying for a long time. Excuse me.
Bless you. Bless you again. And we're going for three.
Three. It's always three or four for me.
Is it?
Spencer has been saying for a long time that he believes in kind of ecosystems and doesn't believe in exclusives quite as much as his peers, which it's always been funny to see what he says and then what he actually does, because sometimes he'll say that and then release a game just on Xbox. So that's always been kind of interesting. But it does feel like they've been trending in this direction for a while. I think it really started about 2016 or 2017, I forget exactly when, but at some point they said, we are now going to release all of our games on PC. And that to me was them giving up on the console business in the long term, or giving up on selling as many consoles as PlayStation long term. Because once you start releasing all of your games on PC at the same time as you release them on console, that is essentially saying you don't have to buy this console, you can just get stuff on PC. We're seeing PlayStation trend in that direction too. We'll see if it becomes same day releases with PC for them. But yeah, that's the future. Dedicated exclusives are not really something that makes sense today.
It was interesting to me as someone who, I mean, I play games everywhere, cover Xbox is like the hobbyist approach, to see Xbox had such a blank slate as far as like what they could have in their catalog to release for so long. And now it seems like their catalog is too full. They just delayed Fable, and it doesn't feel like that's going to be a huge hit, at least, you know, big picture. But now everything's going everywhere. I never know. Yeah.
The Fable, I mean, Fable 2 was a hit, wasn't it? Weren't the Fable games pretty successful up until they that were. Next one and they fell apart? I mean, Fable, Fable could be, if that game gets like a 90 plus Metacritic and feels like a this like impactful like RPG full of consequences and like fascinating mechanics where you like plant an acorn and it turns into a tree like Peter Molyneux once promised, that game could be a hit. Fantasy RPGs are in vogue these days, so you never know.
One of the things that I'm curious about, particularly given the delay, Avowed and South of Midnight not launching on PlayStation, Doom is, makes sense from a development standpoint. But
yeah, Fable, Avowed and South of Midnight, that feels like just kind of vestiges of a previous plan, and it was too late to make the call to be like, but those I'm sure will come to PlayStation at some point in the near future. Whereas Fable, I think the shift, which really started happening like early 2024, when that started happening, I think Fable would have enough time for them to put together a PlayStation version, whereas these two games did not.
Do you anticipate Fable being multi-platform like day one?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think everything will. I don't know about day one. I don't know exactly what their strategy is going to be, but I'd be shocked if there were any Xbox exclusives like moving forward, starting, I don't know, whenever their plan like comes into full view.
I wonder the same, particularly when I look at games like State of Decay 3 and how it's trying to go for a bigger audience and more interweaving of gameplay. Gears of War,
yeah, the service games especially, like you definitely don't want a service game to be limited on to just one console. And Xbox, even before all this started, they would put some of their service games, I believe Grounded was released after Obsidian had been purchased by Xbox, and that was released across platforms. So right, or was it more recently that it came to PlayStation? I don't remember actually.
Originally published, Private Division published it first, Grounded, right?
No, that was Outer Worlds, the private division published.
Is that what I'm thinking of?
Grounded. Here, I can look this up real quick. But
yeah, there's no way we could find out on these magic boxes in front.
Oh no. It was not released on PlayStation until last year, so no, that wasn't a good example. But Minecraft might be the best example of like a service game that was just kind of like supported across all platforms. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like I just don't see Xbox like playing the exclusive game for much longer. It seems like they're trending in the direction of just putting everything on PlayStation, which hopefully everybody is happy with, because like the only advantage of exclusives, I mean, I guess I can see the argument of like, hey, I bought an Xbox and now I feel ripped off because I thought it would play exclusive games and now I should have just bought a PlayStation. What the hell, Phil Spencer? But I think long, and I think short term, yes, you're going to piss off some fans as a result of that, but long term it is healthier for everybody if everything is available on every platform.
I think, you know, I know you have a hard out pretty soon. It was asked by a bunch of people in my Discord community, and I saw it in chat just kind of scrolling briefly. Your thoughts on AI and the way that some of these companies are approaching AI. You do a lot of conversations with workers' culture, with unions, and people's work being honored and respected. And here we are with Xbox and other companies, of course, but Xbox being the example, coming out with Muse and AI and art around it. Any comments or thoughts on that? I'd love to pick your brain.
Yeah, man. I mean, I was just this afternoon, I just posted about this on Blue Sky this afternoon. I'm having some people over, so I was like Googling how many pizza should you get for 8 adults, and Google's AI is like to me, you should get 6 large pizzas or 8 medium pizzas for 8 adults. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? AI is like so broken and busted and like consistently incorrect that I feel like we kind of, all this hype has existed before there's even a working model of like AI actually doing anything interesting or cool. Don't get me wrong, I mean, OpenAI, I'm fascinated by it. It seems like it's been useful for a lot of people for like productivity, and it can be a useful tool if you use it in the right way. But as far as generating content or even like answering basic questions, it is so bad and wrong all the time that it just feels like chasing illusions, in the same way that NFTs 3 years ago were just chasing trends for nonsensical reasons, or like the metaverse or whatever's next. So to me, it all just seems like a house of cards that is waiting to fall down. But yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, it seems like a lot more hype and sizzle than it is actual results, and we have yet to see many actual good things come out of AI.
I'm curious how developers feel when they see something like Muse being pushed by Microsoft. Do you think that, let me rephrase my question. Do you know if developers had a positive or negative response to seeing something like Muse?
Yeah, I mean, developers, we're talking about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. Fair. So it's hard to say. I think it's fair. It would be fair to broadly say that people are nervous about anything that could potentially put them out of a job, right? So if you're an artist and you're worried, if you're like a modeler or an animator or something, and you're worried that some AI tool could exist to just like do your work in a way that like potentially one day is as good, then yeah, of course it's kind of nerve-wracking. But I don't see that happening, because for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, it feels like you can always tell when something is done in AI. You can tell it's missing something. People want content that is created by humans. People want things that have soul attached. Like, nobody wants to just be like spoon-fed like slop garbage from AI. And the only people who say they do and think it's cool are people who are trying to sell you things and grift off of this stuff. So I don't know that there's really a market for that sort of thing. Yeah, I don't know. I'm extremely skeptical that any of this is going to be lasting, except maybe in a few fields. I mean, voice acting has been a big point of contention. The voice actors, a lot of voice actors have been on strike as a result of AI. And if you listen to AI voice actors, I mean, it's hard to tell that they are not humans. So that is definitely one area where I would be freaking out if I were a voice actor, because of the potential of AI there. But and so maybe we'll see advances to the point where like it is actually pretty good and you can't tell the difference in some ways. But I don't know. I mean, humans want art made by humans, and that's never going to change. So maybe it'll change the nature of how art is made, maybe it'll mean that like different types of art need to be created, and maybe it'll just lead to this oversaturation of slop and people have to just tune it out and stop playing AAA games entirely as a result. I don't know, but like humans want human art, and that's never going to change. So I think that there's hopefully people take some comfort in that at least.
I know for me in playing, you know, I both enjoy Avowed. I felt like people made that. It felt like people made that game.
It feels very handcrafted. Yeah. And that's part of what's cool about it is that it feels like very designed and very kind of deliberate in its levels and exploration. And yeah, it's good stuff. I probably have time for one more question or topic and then I got to run.
All I will ask for you to do is please plug your work. Let people know where they can find you, Jason, because I appreciate you taking the time today, being willing to come on, sharing insight and into the WB closings.
Yeah, I'm easy to find on the internet. My new book is called Play Nice, The Rise, Fall, and Future of Blizzard Entertainment. It's pretty cool. I got a podcast called Triple Click. It's pretty cool. And you can find me on Bloomberg.com.
There you go. And guys, I'll be putting his link into the show notes momentarily. Jason, stick around as we do the exit. Thank you all for listening to XEP. Support your creators and artists wherever you can. Have a fantastic rest of your day. Take care.